Well, hi, everybody. I'm Mark Ciaffardini with Go See Talk. We are 10 days till Christmas. Our extra special guest today is legendary composer Howard Blake, the man who is synonymous with Christmas. I think he should earn the title of Father Christmas. The work he's done to symphony halls and soundtracks and TV and films have just done wonderful things for the cinematic community. This is an honor to have you on the show. This is a bucket list item for sure. Mr. Blake, welcome. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. Nice to be talking to you.
Let's go back to the very, very beginning. What instrument, piece of music, what got you into this world that you inhabit so very well?
I was just talking to a famous recorder player early on this morning, John Turner, and he asked me the same thing. And I said, actually, the first instrument I ever played, I was given a flageolet by a very old aunt. He says, it's like a brass recorder. And I used to play it insufferably all around the house and drive the whole family mad and say, will you stop playing that? So I started there. Then I started playing the piano when I was about six. And my father didn't want me to have lessons. He said, we've had enough. And so I actually did something. I found a book and I wrote the names of all the notes on the piano in indelible pencil on the piano. And then I wrote them in and I found I could read music and write it. And that was fine until they saw what I'd done to the piano, which didn't go very, very well. So I actually, and I never thought I would be a composer, but I played the piano and then I sang in a choir and then I was later as an organist in church. And I was going to go and have a sort of normal life, and then I happened to meet a pianist who said you should go to a good teacher, and I went, and this teacher, a girl called Christine Pember, she put me in for a scholarship, and this scholarship happened to be on the same day as my university scholarship to go and study history, but the music one came first, and I went in for I won 3 years paid up scholarship as a pianist at the Royal Academy of Music, which was, and then on the back of that, I got a university grant for it. So actually, I still thought I was going to be a pianist, although family wasn't really, they couldn't really understand such a thing possible, let alone, it wasn't in musical at all. So, I then had to go for my interview at the Royal Academy, and I sat with the two wardens, and they said, "Have you brought some harmony exercises with you?" And I said, "Yeah, I just brought one, and I produced a full length piano trio which I'd written." And they said, "What's that?" I said, "It's a piano trio." And they said, "Did you write that?" I said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, why the hell are you studying piano?" Why the hell aren't you studying composition? I said, I didn't know you could. So I said, okay, I'll take a second subject. So I went again and I started studying composition. And I was a very bad student. I never did anything I was told to do. But I started, actually, my very first term at the academy, this same warden, he said to me, "We've got a library firm, a library music firm around the corner, Weinberger's are called." And he said, "Would you like to? Maybe you'd like to write something for them." I said, "What is it? What's a library firm?" He said, "So it's stuff you write and you put it on a film if it fits." And he said, "I know that they want some music to go with the opening of Parliament with the Queen next week, and they're looking for something. So go and see Fred." So I went round to see Fred, and he said, "Could you write a piece like a Remembrance March? It wants to be very solemn. It's a bit like maybe the Dam Busters, but upside down. Ah, so okay. So I actually wrote the Dam Busters march upside down, slowed it down, and I called it Remembrance March. And it actually was the first thing, professional thing I wrote. And next day it was on in the Houses of Parliament with the Queen. So that's the first thing I wrote. Instant success.
What was it called? And how long was that?
Well, I'll tell you something else about that piece. It was the first piece. One of your presidents, it was after the end of the Korean War, and he made a speech to the whole of the nation, and they used my Remembrance March.
So not only is music a universal language, it can also cross cultures and be used in different governments. That's great.
It is true. I mean, I've actually got the bear on in Taiwan. Today, actually. Was it? No, yesterday it starts. It's running in Taiwan. The bear on the cinema screen with full orchestra for 4 days. So I got stuff going on in. I mean, they're not so chicken as we are here, that we're not running anything here, but they're running for me in Dubai and also in Beijing, I think. So, in normalist time, I get stuff going on all over the world. I can't go.
Well, that sounds very interesting. Yeah, how are they describing these public exhibitions when we're in more or less quarantine that kind of floats? How does that work?
I can use this, can't I?
Yeah, you can still use them.
If you look, it's only film of Snowman stage show showing Dubai 14 to 22nd December.
Amazing. That's great. All we get in, I'm in Texas, so I have a small relationship with the Dallas Symphony, and all they talk about are the virtual performances, churches doing the same thing. So, no, that's a... If you can get out there and see live music, please go.
Well, I can't go anywhere. But I've never been there anyway. But I had this huge success with the Snowman. They're used to doing that. So the bear is, that is Snowman in Dubai. It's got the wrong piece.
Okay.
But the bear's going on somewhere else.
well, still, it's another Raymond Briggs movie. And you had your music added to it, so
it's not. Raymond had nothing to do with the Snowman movie, actually.
Howard.
He did draw the original picture book. It's true.
Well, that's kind of the elephant in the room. I think much like people who've been Star Wars movie, you need to be prepared that's all you're going to talk about the rest of your life. Art, do you want to open it up? Should we talk about the Snowman, or should we save that for the end?
Talk about something else, yeah.
Okay. Ridley and Tony Scott.
Yes.
You've done some work for them. Let's talk about that relationship. How did you even meet Ridley to begin with?
I met Ridley at a time when I started doing television commercials, like late 60s, where they suddenly... Everything was television commercials with soundtracks. And I got an agent who got me into that. And one of the directors who was directing a lot of commercials was Ridley. And I did a number of music tracks for him. And one in particular was for SR toothpaste. I don't know if you have that in...
That's new to me.
Okay, it doesn't really matter. It's a toothpaste anyway. And there was a scene in it, and it was supposed to look like Siberia, and there's these Cossacks in the snow. And really said, could you write something, you know, very Russian and sounds like Borodin or something? I can only afford 9 instruments, but I want it sounds huge. And I said, don't worry. So I do a track for him, and he thought it was great. And I think it won a prize for it. And then I do occasionally, I do other small things for him. And then out of the blue, he at that time, he hadn't made a film. He couldn't get in. They wouldn't let him in. And then one day he rang me and he said, I've got a film. I got a film called The Duelists, he said. And would you write the music for me? And I said, well, I'm actually not writing films at the moment. And he said, where are you? I said, well, I'm living in a watermill down in an 18th century watermill down in Sussex. I've given up music completely. And he said, well, you got a watermill. He said, I've got a new producer called David Putnam. He said, and could we come and see the watermill? I said, if you like, come. So I met them at a station down outside, out in the country. And we spent the whole day running this watermill, letting waterfalls down. And I had a great time. And at the end, and all the day, he's talking about Duelist. And it got to 6 o'clock. And he said, we've got to go back to London. Come and see it. I went back to London. And I saw, and the minute they put the first frame up, I was, what a shot. These just standing dead still with the sword poised against him. Amazing shot. I said, I like it. So will you do it? So I said, I think I will. So I said, what have you got in mind? And Ridley said, well, you know, we want sort of electronic. I said, it's set in the 18th century or something. Oh, yeah. So, well, I think you want an orchestral score. Oh, he said, nobody writes orchestral scores anymore. So David said to Ridley, he said, listen to him, Ridley. No, he knows. You know about film. Howard knows about music. So David overwrote, really, and he said, so what do you want? I said, I'd like to write for a full orchestral score, but with that, I can cover all the things, going to Russia, being in France, being Germany, Italy. I mean, it's such a varied film. The sound of the orchestra will cover all those things, but also it'll give it a great, it'll make it sound like a real epic. So David said, do it. I said, okay. I said, what about the end credits? And Ridley said, doesn't matter about the end credits. So David said, what do you mean it doesn't matter about the end credits? He said, of course it matters about the end credits. So he said, what would you, he said, I tell you what, Howard, Mr. David, he said, you know, the end of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, this amazing Liebestod. He said, could you write something like that? Great. Yeah, I said, I could write something like that. I said, how long should it be? He said, I don't care how long it is. He said, if I haven't got long enough titles, I'll make some extra credits. I keep it going. Oh, I said, great, I like working for you already. So that was the start of it. And actually it was a great score to it. Now in the middle of that viewing, at the back of that first viewing, we get to a scene when they're in Russia with Cossacks. And I looked around at Ridley, I said, just a minute. Yes, he said, you're right, that's our toothpaste. I said, I won't tell anybody. So he took this CD, and he said, and that's why you got the film. Oh, so that's quite a nice story about Ridley is a genius director, and I was very, very happy to have worked with him. And I personally still think that's his greatest film, and it won the prize for best the Critics Top Award at Cannes Festival, which I won a couple of prizes with it myself, and it was great, and somehow or other Ridley. I mean, he then went off to Hollywood and got it. He started working for Fox. And he would like to have gone on working me, but we couldn't do it again. And I see him from time to time, and we're great friends.
The end credits of The Duelist is about 3 minutes, and it's fantastic. And usually the end credits is an opportunity for a composer to uncork and use the things, the themes that maybe were done in the film to elaborate on them. Please tell me about the assembly of the orchestra for The Duelist, because sometimes it can be bouncy, but everything feels very maybe small scale. What was the size of the orchestra?
It would have been 6 first violins, 4 second violins, 2 violas, 2 cellos, double bass, and then there would have been there's about not maybe 2 woodwind. I think flute and oboe, and then about 4 horns, which is what gives it when I need a push. Mm-hmm. There's no trumpets or trumpets, so there's 4 horns, and then percussion, harp. So, yeah, not such a big orchestra, but written in a symphonic way. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to afford any more players than that.
I guess for Ridley's first out of the gate, he really did gangbusters, because, like you said, he went on, and it's a shame that you couldn't go with him. But I think you've charted your own courses fantastically.
Well, I was actually asked to do Alien.
Seriously?
Yeah, and I actually did start work on it. However, Ridley, at that moment, he signed a contract with Fox in Harlem. Okay. And actually, they didn't sign me. They signed him. I think that's... And so they said, I lost the contract. Which was sad, but I went to, I wrote a lot more films for other people after that, and maybe I don't know, I've had a very varied career, and you know, it's no good crying over spilt milk. You just have to keep going, you know.
Well, you got your chance to do another space epic. I mean, if Ridley went the H.R. Giger way, you went the his name, but Flash Gordon. You went Flash Gordon. Did some additional music. How was that decidedly broken between Queen and yourself?
Well, that's most of my stories are pretty crazy, but Flash is probably the most crazy. I'm sitting here one afternoon, I don't mind my own business, and I get a call from Dino De Laurentiis, who's the great Italian impresario, and he said, "Mr. Blake, we are terrible trouble. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "We've got Queen here. We've got the Royal Philharmonic here. We've got a film." He said, "This film is costing me £50 million." He said, "I said, I'm paying, I'm borrowing £50 million." I said, "Well, that's got nothing to do with me. It's not your problem." So. He said, and so what? I said, "Well, what's the trouble?" He said, "We haven't got any music." I said, "You've got the orchestra there, and you haven't got..." "Yes." "What, the whole Royal Philharmonic?" "Yes." He said, "Can you come out?" So I went out to Wembley Studio, CTS Wembley, and there's the Royal Philharmonic in this huge studio, and the whole group, Queen there, with Freddie Mercury and Brian May, and then Dino, and there's also the head of music from 20th Century Fox is there. Or was it Universal? One of them. So I said, "Well, why haven't you got any music?" "Well," he said, "Queen, they promised to. They would provide the music. And so they've had 3 months. And so we were the orchestra, and anyway, they had given this job to their assistant, who was a cellist, who made arrangements for their pop songs. But he actually hadn't written anything, and he thought he could sort of sing it to the orchestra and improvise it.
Yeah, because that works. That works.
I'm afraid not. Anyway, so they get everything. And I mean, I spoke to the orchestra. I found out later. And, I said, and so he'd gone in and he said, right, look right there. So you'll see up. Flash comes in top right-hand corner of the screen. You see, he comes down. When he does, go, boom, boom. I say, sorry? What do you want us to play? Well, you know, like, So this guy is seriously nuts. You know?
Wow.
So they did try to do this, like improvising it. And they'd spent 2 days, and they'd managed to record about 3 seconds of music. Which didn't work. So they were absolutely desperate. And so Dino said to me, he said, this is Thursday afternoon. And he said, could you write a new score by Monday? And I said, well, actually, if you had Tchaikovsky and Bach and Beethoven all here and asked them, they still couldn't write it by Monday. I mean, it's enormous. This is like a 3-hour film. And it's like wall-to-wall music.
Yeah.
And it obviously it needs an orchestral score. So anyway, I said, and Dino says, you know, I'm £50 million and paying interest. I said, you have to forget that, you know, you must not worry about money. I would do it, but it have you measured? Is it all measured up? Have you got the time? Have you got the timings? Bar times. Everybody goes. Oh, have you got? Nobody knew what. Nobody had. They hadn't even timed it. They hadn't got a music editor on board. I said, this is sort of loony tunes. But anyway, I said, well, we have to get it really well timed. And anyway, finally. I said I needed a month, and they said we can't afford it. Anyway, I said, well, as soon as I get the timings, I can get started, and yeah, I can do it. And anyway, finally, you know, it's like the first thing is the editor said I'm going on holiday tomorrow. I said you are not going on holiday. You better not, I kill you. So anyway. By the time I'd actually got all the bits together and I'd got my chart of exactly the timings of all the scenes, exactly what we want, and I also got the bits of all the bits that Queen had recorded and the Freddie Mercury and so on, I actually had 10 days left.
Wow.
To the date that we fixed to record it. It's a very short time. And I wrote the score of Flash Gordon complete for a large orchestra of 70 in 10 days, fully written in pencil. And I actually very nearly died because the last 4 days, I actually didn't sleep. I just writing, and I felt great, Itch, and I was writing. I can't believe I can write this fast. And it was good, and I felt fine. And actually, that Sunday morning, we were recording on a Monday at 9:30 at Dunham, and I can remember very clearly that I finally finished this score at 6 a.m. on the Sunday, and I've been working for 4 days without sleeping at all.
Wow.
It's a very dangerous thing to do. And I thought, it's funny, I feel great. And I went for a big walk down the Thames. It was a beautiful day, I can remember it. And I got back, got in the car, went up. And they're all sitting, waiting, all frightened out of their lives. I won't turn up. Anyway, I did it. I recorded for 3 days solid, 6 sessions. Went out in the evening, felt great. And then I came home and went to sleep. Now, my wife at that time, she was with 2 young children. She just moved out. Or just after I started writing, she did the whole hands. I'm on the phone 3 o'clock in the morning to a Hollywood, and people coming in and motorbikes. And she said, I can't. She came back and she couldn't wake me up. So finally she did. And I looked and she said, I thought you were going to Paris. I said, I'm going to Paris tomorrow, Thursday. She said, it's now Saturday. I said, you're kidding. No, she said, it's wow. Not. I'd been asleep since Wednesday evening. I'd been asleep for 4 days. Anyway, she couldn't wake me up. She got a doctor in. And the doctor shot me with Benzedrine to wake me up. And he said, if you hadn't got me in, you would never have woken up. He said, it's extremely dangerous to not sleep. You lose the oxygen to your brain. So I think, you know, Dino was very lucky. Because if I died, I'd have sued him.
Or haunted him or something to that effect. Oh, wow.
Anyway, the thing is, I did write a great orchestral score for Flash. And I am, if you look at the film, we ran it here at Olympic Studios. My daughter said, come, do you want to see it again? And I hadn't watched it for years and years. And it stands up pretty well. And I'm the only person, I get a full screen credit on my own. And I'm the only person who does. And I thought, well, actually, I am credited with the score. So. But it was true. Obviously, the Queen, they had their big hit. Flash, mm-hmm. that was their big thing.
No, how's it go? I don't know, Howard. Tell me, how's it go?
Flash,
There we go.
Flash, Anyway, no, the best tune in it, funnily enough, is while I was still writing, Freddie Mercury came to see me one day and he said, I've got a great tune. I would really like this Flight to Arborea. And he said, it's in my head. He said, maybe you could fit it into the score somehow. I said, well, how does it go? I said, well, sing it to me. So he sings it. And I wrote it down as he sang it. So he said, I could get somebody to, you know, write that up. So, and it was good, but he went. I said, that's fabulous, Fred. That's fabulous. I'm going to put that in. So that became an essential part of the score, actually. Mm-hmm. And that comes in on string. And that was Freddie's tune.
Wow. And who did the vocals on that? That's a woman singing that, right?
No, that's Freddie Mercury singing falsetto.
Oh, no way.
Oh,
okay.
I can do it. Oh.
Okay. Okay, well, this interview is giving and giving and giving. Thank you.
Yeah, so it's amazing I survived it. That really was a trial by fire. That was.
No. Fire, landmines, meteors, man, you survived it all.
I survived it. Yeah.
10 days. Wow. You know, I'd heard crazy stories about Michael Kamen doing 3 hours of music in 2 weeks, or John Carpenter doing the theme to Halloween in 3 days. But man, that's and you know, the movie was so in flux. I saw a documentary about how bifurcated the production was: the Italian sets, the American actors, Tall Paul, Sam.
Yeah.
Nobody really knew what they were doing. And I think, you know, like you said, the one thing that unifies it is the orchestral score, and the Queen sound. I mean, way to bridge the gap, guys.
Yeah, there's surprisingly a large amount of orchestral music in it. I mean, they push that, but actually you need that. It would not have worked without a full orchestral score, because it just needs to keep the whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Very big film. Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, it probably would have been just a long music video. But yeah, you gave it some flourishes, and that's what people remember. It does stand up.
Yeah. So is that the end of the interview?
No, we've got on us 16 more hours.
Oh, we better get going. Yeah. No.
Let's transfer over to Tony Scott. You did The Hunger for him, if I understand it right. You did that part of the day, and then you went to a Shall Remain Nameless Snowman the other half of the day. You kind of split your time.
Well, it's a funny thing. I actually had been I'd been before that, the film, just before that, I'd been to Hollywood to write SOS, a film called SOS Titanic, History of the Titanic, big film in Hollywood. And I came back to England because, first of all, my wife had just had a baby. And I'd been asked if I would write the music for The Coal Miner's Daughter, which I think was with Universal. And I had actually done a film with the director of that, Stronger Than the Sun, in England. And I'd done Agatha. Agatha, which is Agatha. It's just been released after 40 years. I had a terrific bad time on Agatha because they thought that the score dominated the film too much. And I was so proud of this. Everybody loved the film. It was the same team, actually. It was David Putnam. Michael Apted. And Michael Apted then, on the back of it, he went out to Hollywood. Then he's asking me to do this Coal Miner's Daughter. And I'm torn between that and going back to England. And because of my wife having a baby, I decided I would go back to England. Because Tony Scott had asked me to do, would I do The Hunger? And it was a very interesting idea. Tony said, I want to use all great classical music. I want all, but re-record it. But, and I want somebody to choose very carefully and make up, the music can be very important. So, and I want you to, you bombard me with ideas from classical music, bring round records every morning. So I would go down to his place in Wimbledon with a pile of discs and tapes, and we talk. And it was a very interesting film to do. In fact, I didn't really write much, but I was musical director. I discovered this amazing duet from Lakme, which is now world famous for advertising British Airways. It's still doing it after 45 years. And that, I discovered that and I recorded that. That was done with two early music sopranos with no wobble. And it actually changed the world of opera, actually, because... Really? Soprano started singing without a vibrato. So that was had a real, it's amazing if you did that. Colossal to have a piece like that that's run like in every airport, every day, 24 hours, all over the world. So that was an interesting thing. Then of course, we had Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon there. And I used to go out to lunch with them and David Bowie and Tony Scott. This is my day, you know. Our office is pretty good, like mingling with the mighty there. And that wasn't the whole of that score was very interesting to do. And if you watch it, you hear all there's Ravel in it and Schubert and Bach, and it's all woven in. And then there is a certain amount of electronic music as well. But it's quite an interesting score. Now, it just so happened I'd come back, I'd left Hollywood, like day two, I'm into the writing, supervising The Hunger. I mean, day two. And I get a call from in London saying, I'd presented this idea of a film called The Snowman to Channel 4 about 3 months ago. And I hadn't heard back about it. And they said, well, we'd have to get some backing. I thought, well, didn't think it was happening. Like, I'm day two into the hunger. And they said, we've got the money for the snowman. They want to do it. Channel 4 want to do it. When? I said, right now. Oh, my God. So I think, oh, right. So I thought, well, this is a bit tricky. So I actually was working on the day, during the day on the hunger. I was in the studios with David Bowie and Catherine Deneuve. And I was giving her piano lessons, actually. I'll tell you more about that thing. And then in the evening, I was writing The Score of the Snowman. Wow. So I wrote those two, like, in tandem. And The Snowman was something I so much... I always had had this dream of writing a whole score with nothing but music. No dialogue. And I said, the only condition I'll do it is... there's no dialogue. And Channel 4 agreed that. And I just knew it would work. And my God, it did work. But it was a pretty busy year, as you can imagine, doing this tour at once.
Well, I mean, if you got no sleep doing Flash, how did you manage the hunger and the snowman splitting your time like that?
I think I probably looked slightly drawn. I survived. No, it was so different, actually. It didn't really matter to me, because actually if I'd had to write a score for The Hunger, I couldn't have done it. What I was merely doing with The Hunger was actually supervising existing music. And so
gotcha.
And that's a very different matter, because when I'm for instance writing The Duelist, I mean, all I think in my head is that music. I can't think of anything else. I couldn't write two scores simultaneously, but I could do The Hunger as that. That's a music supervision job. It's a conducting job. That's easy. So all my time thinking about music was going over the snowman. So that was good. So I finished it by the summer. You still know, the hunger was in like February, March, April, and then finished off and then recorded the snowman late in the early summer. And the rest is history with the snowman. Well, it's very, very successful.
Well, you know, there's another famous director who used a lot of classical music to a great effect, unexpected effect. Stanley Kubrick's 2001, The Space Odyssey. Did Tony use that as maybe a guidepost or maybe reference, or where did the classical music come from?
I know about this. It's quite a funny story about it. Stanley Kubrick, he lives in Stanmore. He lived in Stanmore, North London. He had this idea, he wanted to have Strauss. He wanted that idea of Richard Strauss, das sprach Zarathustra. That was the music, that huge.
That's how you say it.
Something like that. He wanted to use that Richard Strauss, very big for the beginning. And he was in the cutting room at Elstree, which is where I used to work. And just down the road from Stanmore. And he asked his editor assistant, he said, go down to the record shop and buy some Strauss. And he wanted Richard Strauss, you see. The assistant went down to the record shop and said, have you got Strauss? And he gave him a record of Johann Strauss.
Easy mistake?
A complete mistake, which is like dance music. So they have the first scene of the rocket going into space. So he said, let's try it and put it on this. He said, what the hell is that? He said, it's Strauss. That's Johann Strauss, that's a waltz. And then he said, actually, just a minute. He said, it sort of works. Sounds crazy, but it sort of works, he said. Yeah. But anyway, let's leave it. He said, go back to the shop and get Richard Strauss. So he goes back to the shop and he buys a Richard Strauss. Also Sprach Zarathustra.
Yes, brought that back. And then they put that on for the beginning with the megaliths. And that really did work. So it happened by mistake that they had two different Strausses writing the score. Now, my friend Laurie Johnson, who happens to, he still does happens to live in the next door house to Stanley Kubrick there. He was actually taken on to fill in some of the rest of the music. So between them, that those were the three people, and then they took another composer on, but they didn't. I forget who it was now. They dropped it all. But it's very odd. So that it was a sort of a crazy mistake, where you end on a very big film that you suddenly got this Viennese waltz playing on a rocket. But it was. It's just one of those sort of amazing things that worked by mistake more than anything.
Well, yeah, those happy accidents, they can really impact and forever change a creative endeavor. Do you have any happy accidents that yourself can recall and say, I'm so glad that happened? I mean, maybe not as grand as Strauss, but what happens when you're composing and orchestrating?
In a way, I mean, the snowman, I had actually, coming, we promised we wouldn't talk about it, but in a way, I had already written Walking in the Air, the song from, I'd written it on a beach in Cornwall in 1970. And I knew it was a marvelous tune. I came back to London and I tried various things with it. And nobody was interested in it at all. And I didn't do anything. And I then went out to Montreal to do an animated film called The Remarkable Rocket. And this film, it was Reader's Digest, just with my children's on that, and they were going to make The Happy Prince. And I thought, oh, that tune will work on the happy flying. The prince flying through the sky with the little birds, that worked marvelous. So I say, I've got this wonderful tune for it. And the director said, we'd love you to do the music for Happy Prince. Right. So I said, I've got this job. I'll finish it off and it won't, I'll be back. Anyway, I had to come back to it and I actually finished writing the whole score of Snowman for the Happy Prince. I then ring up and the director said, and I said, I've written you the most fantastic tune. And he said, I'm terribly sorry, Sid, but there's another composer's just taking it off you, the job. And I said, that's terrible. I mean, how can you do that to me? So he said, it's my assistant producer and I've given him control of me. Anyway, you've lost it. And I said, well, who is this composer? He says, it's Ron Goodwin. Oh, I said, I know Ron, I'm gonna ring him up. So I rang up Ron. I said, Ron, you've just stolen this job off me in Montreal. And he said, yes. He said, it's a tough business, isn't it? I said, is that all you've got to say? Yes, he said. Oh, I said, well, I'll remember that, Ron. Now, that's about 1975. 6 years later, it's now 1981. I quite budget this guy, Jerry. He's come over from Montreal and he rings me and he said, we'll meet for lunch. We'd like to meet for lunch in Soho. He said, meet up, I've got to just drop in and pick up a check from a film company. It won't take a minute. And then we go have so long. Okay. Anyway, go into this cartoon company and the director, John Coates, of the director, he said, I know you. He said, we met in New York. You write feature films, don't you? Music. Yes, I said, how black? He said, I'm a bit out of place for me, really. He said, I've just written a very tiny 8-minute demo. And I just wonder if I had some music written by a composer called Ron Goodwin. And I don't think it's quite right.
he said, could I just ask you just to have a look at it for me and give your opinion on it? And I said, in this particular instance, you certainly can. So I see this musical, and I said, that is terrible music, John. I have a tune for you that will kill you. And so I said, listen to this. He said, well, how do I? I said, I'll do a demo for nothing. I did a demo of Walking in There. We put it on it. We took it, and the rest of it, and it went onto the film. And it's the biggest thing I ever. So that's an extraordinary coincidence of the sort, isn't it?
Oh man, that is vindication and karma all wrapped in a present. Here you go.
Isn't it? It's amazing how life does happen like so. Sometimes you think I lost everything, and then what you get comes out of it. Is more than you could have ever imagined.
Oh man, that's if anybody in their life can have one story like that, that is one for the books. Well, let's go back quickly to you. You were talking about working with David Bowie and Catherine teaching her piano. You had a story about that.
Tony Scott, see, you know, we've taken on Catherine Deneuve. She doesn't play the piano, but she's supposed to be the greatest. She's 5,000 years old, Dracula person, but she's the greatest concert pianist in the world. She's got to look pretty convincing. She's going to play this big grand piano in the set in London, you know. And so, I said, well, we'll have you get a coach. She had to learn how to move, how to look. She was living in Paris at the time, and she got a coach over there. And I went over there one day to see her, and there wasn't a piano. And she was, I heard a bit, I thought it's not very convincing, but I don't know what we do about it. But I thought, well, it probably won't matter too much. But then we get into production. This is then... Back in London, we had a huge house in Curzon Street. The whole house was taken over, and this big music room, and she's playing. And she's in Dracula, you know, and she's playing this Ravel. And it looks terrible. So Tony's by, he said, come on, do something. I go up, I said, and I said, Kathleen, is it all right? Could I just move you a little bit? Certainly, she's come on. Please. So I'm moving around. So Tony, I said, that's great. Right, we shoot it like that. So, okay, get off the set. So I said, okay. So then she goes, no, he said, Howard, you've got, no, try it again. You try it somewhere, he said. You've got to be doing that to Catherine for it to work, manipulating her. I said, well, how am I going to do that? I'm going to be being shot. He said, well, get under the stool, get under the piano stool and move her bum around. I said, please. Tony, this is Catherine Deneuve you're talking about. So I go and speak to her. I said, it's very embarrassing. I said, Tony would like me to move you around from underneath. I said, would it? You didn't mind at all. So I spent the whole day manipulating Catherine Deneuve's body.
It's a dirty job.
Wow.
And it worked. I'd push her around. I mean, so go on, do something. And it worked. And it looked like she was playing. Wow. So that's quite a story.
You should get two title cards for that. You should get one for choreography and one for composing.
So we had a bit of fun on that day, on that film. Yeah, in fact, on the
on the film, it is actually me playing the piano.
Well, let's take a sidestep from one grand piano to a very small piano. You did the music box theme for The Changeling that George C. Scott played in the film.
Yeah.
How did that come about, and why did you not get complete score responsibility for that film?
I was commissioned to do a complete score. It was a Canadian production, I think Canadian American, I'm not sure. It was being made in Vancouver. And I had just done a film with the director, Peter Medak, very good director. I'd done a film with him, The Odd Job. And he asked me to do the complete score of The Changeling. So I said, I'd love to do it. And he said, you're right, very similar scenario, because the story was, it was George C. Scott, who was supposed to be a great composer and concert pianist. And he goes to this old ancient house on the outskirts of Vancouver, and there is a music box, and he turns it on and it plays this little tune. And he becomes obsessed with it. He thinks it's such a beautiful tune that he would develop it into a whole concerto. It would be his greatest work of his time. What a gift of a thing to write. So Peter Medak asked me if I would write the tune first, like it's on a music box. I did it on Celeste, like tinkle, tinkle. And then develop it into a full-blown concert work. So he said, and we can't really start the film until you've done that. It's essential to the whole scores. I said, that's fine. So I did the piece. And it went... Pretty tune, and it's proved to be, because I'm still selling lots of copies of it to this day, actually. And I was all geared up to go out to Vancouver. They then made the film, and I was going to write the full score. At the last minute, I get a message from Canadian immigration control or something like that. Said, are you Canadian? No. Why are you doing this film? Have you got a license to, you know, you were taking work off Canadian.
Wow.
So I said, well, I was booked to be the musical director and composer. So, well, I don't think you do. Anyway, they took it off me I found that pretty difficult to believe. And Peter Medak was extremely annoyed because he wanted me to do the full score. And I would have loved to do that full score, but I didn't. The two guys credited were actually the two sound editors on the film. They weren't composers. However, it was manufactured. It's credited to three composers, one of them being myself. But I didn't do any of the actual score. But the score does work very well. It's a very successful film. But I think it works. The tune, that tune itself, I think, did make it. And I get letters from... I had a letter recently from a lady in Los Angeles saying, you know, I do embroidery, and I'm embroidering a music box with your theme on the front for Christmas for my daughter. So I get all sorts of strange, you know, strange things happening with the music. It's a very popular tune, yeah. But every story I tell you about
none of them are ever clear cut, because there are people, especially when big films, and which may be the people are joggling to get in there, get a slice of the action. And you take your, you know, I take my eyes off it for a second. Somebody's in there, you know. I mean, it's very competitive. And so that's, but also, I mean, I think it's just something you have to take about the whole culture. It was probably the same for Shakespeare, actually. You know, people would rush in and write a scene when he was looking and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, the Changeling, like you said, it's well received. It's lauded as a great thriller, a horror movie. But you mentioned Agatha earlier as unreleased works that you're proud of. You also have Ghost Stories that you're are trying to release this year. Would you like to talk a little bit more about that?
There it is. I just got it. I got a box full a couple of weeks ago. Ghost Stories. And it's the music from The Canterville Ghost and Amityville 3D. And they're very different. But Amityville 3D was a score I'm rather proud of. And it resulted from my having done Flash Gordon, because Dino had asked me to write the score for Flash Gordon. When he was so pleased with his next film was, in fact, Amityville 3D. And he said, I insist that you do this for me, because you did such a wonderful job. You saved my life on Flash Gordon. It should have gone to Lalo Schifrin. Lalo Schifrin had done Amityville 1, Amityville 2. And I... As I say, it was insisted on by Dino that I do, and I apologise to Lalo, but he's okay about it. I think.
He's got some other things to do.
He's doing okay. Yeah.
But so did you get more than a month? I mean, you asked for a month on Flash Gordon. How much time did you get from Dino? Did he make good?
I remember I went out to Hollywood. I spent a week in Hollywood measuring it. And I stayed at Chateau Marmont, I remember. And we went to there was a vaudeville club right opposite. And we all met at the vaudeville club and talked about the Amityville 3D. Don't think it's there anymore. Anyway, I was there for a week. I came back. I had 2 weeks in. I think I wrote Amityville 3D in about 2 to 3 weeks and recorded it in England. So crossing over and back to Hollywood takes time, and because they were cutting it in Hollywood and recording it in English just to make everything as awkward as possible. But I very much enjoyed Amityville. And I think it's a very scary score, actually, especially at the end when you come down this basement steps, and this girl, she's looking serious as like a queen coming down the stairs, and then I know that this horrific monster is in the basement in this world, but the audience don't know that, and this girl doesn't. I'm the only person who knows. So I thought, how do I write this? And I've got the theme going. I've got to make people aware something is very much amiss. And I suddenly thought, I suddenly double or treble the tempo so that. So, and suddenly I go, and she's still going like very slow, and it is so scary. And then at the end, I build up to a colossal, and you go, bow, and you hit this monster. It scared me, so I don't know what it, and I've written it, but I don't know what it does to audience.
Oh, man, and in 3D, no less. So,
Yeah.
They were very proud. When I arrived there in Hollywood, they were very proud. 3D, nobody's done a 3D for ages, and they used, this is going to be break all still record to be, and it's all, you know, the latest, never been. And I mean, it's the, curiously, I don't know that it adds that much somehow. It's, in fact, you start actually being slightly diverted from the story and start thinking, I wonder how they did that. Are we going to see? It's slightly, yeah. There was one very, very scary shot in where this girl is, she's driving down Sunset Boulevard, and so there's a lorry in front with a huge pipe coming out the back, huge pipe. And actually, it drives straight into her. This pipe goes straight through the car and straight through her, which is actually horrible. I think it's one of those horrific things. And I said to Greg, I'd be rather surprised if you got away with that. But they did. It's a pretty scary film. So, yeah, that was Amityville 3, but... No, quite
excellent.
And in that, I also, funny enough, I used the same girl. I used this, there was a marvelous girl soprano, Elaine Gould. And she had sung that Lakme solo in the film we talked about just now. The Hunger.
Okay.
You know, which became the big British Airways. That's Elaine Gould, the high soprano with no vibrato. And she is the soprano also on Amityville 3.
Oh. So,
a lot of people would know that.
sounds like that's your secret weapon, Elaine.
Well, very sad. She was a... She's actually not with us anymore, sad to say. She died young, she got ill, but she was a really phenomenal soprano. And I used her on those two films, like a rare talent. Yeah.
Well, sad that she, like you said, she left too soon.
Yeah.
You know, one of the other questions I had for you is in 1974, you had a piano quartet in A minor.
Oh.
Can you tell us about, I mean, I really like that. It's about 22 minutes. Can you tell us what went into it? And I think it's called Opus 179.
What's the
backstory on that?
What happened to my career about 1971? I mean, I had this period at the end of the 60s. I'd come to London, you know, I'd been scratching around playing in pubs and nothing. And then I suddenly took off and started being offered every film and every I took over writing the Avengers series. I wrote 13 episodes of the Avengers. And then I started immediately doing feature films in England. And then I started doing commercial. I got so unbelievably busy that I was shaking. And Stanley Myers, who's a great friend of mine, he said, you've got to go and see a doctor or something. So I went to see this Indian doctor, and he said, put your hand out. And I put my hand out. He said, oh, yes. He said, you are going to be dead in 5 years.
You are second opinion, please.
Yes. I said, am I paying for this? No, he said, you've got to stop. You've got to stop. You cannot work that hard. You're killing yourself. So I actually, at 1970, I got in a car, drove as far west as I possibly could. I went down to Cornwall, and I lived on a beach for 3 months, and nobody knew where. I just actually gradually came down. And I realized I couldn't go on working at that speed. And then I decided that I didn't want to write hundreds of commercials. I just had to stop. And I did stop because I thought, I want to write good films. and I want to write good music, and I want to go, right, I have some classical music I want to write, independent of film. There's a lot of things I want to do. So I changed my life at that point, 1971. And I actually, I had a trio, a marvelous violinist called Jack Rothstein, and a terrific viola player called Kenneth Essex, and a marvelous cellist called Peter Willison. And we started playing Schubert trios and piano quartets. And they said, could you write us a piano quartet? We were heading for a little concert right in the middle of the country in a barn. It was nothing. And I'm turning down huge thoughts. And everybody said, I tell you what I've turned down in order to write the piano quartet. You won't believe this. It was actually the great, we mentioned him earlier, who lived next door to Laurie Jones.
Mr. Kubrick. Okay. Wow.
Please
go on.
I started writing the piano quartet, and my fixer, Sid Sachs, rang me, and he said, I'd like you to do some Schubert arrangements. I said, I don't do arrangements. Well, he said, it's for a very big film. And He said, well, what are you doing so special? I said, I'm writing a piano quartet. And it's absolutely wonderful. I'm going to go until I finish it. So are you turning it down? I said, yeah, I don't want it. Anyway, it was Stanley Kubrick's Irish film, Barry Lyndon. I turned down Barry Lyndon in order to write the piano quartet.
Wow.
Which everybody thought was out of my mind. But actually, you can't do everything. And funny enough, the fact that Sid had said, if he'd said to me, would you write a score for Stanley Kubrick called Barry Lyndon, I might very well have dropped the piano quartet. When he said arrange Schubert, I thought, no, I don't want to arrange 3 hours of Schubert. I do not want to do that at all. So this is how career, you make these decisions and then you just have to go with them. But I love that. That's because
exactly the one I mean. That's fantastic music.
So, well, I love that, and I'm glad I wrote that. I'm glad I took the time off.
And I'm so glad you did. I really, really enjoy that, because I think one of the things that's amazing is, yes, you needed to slow down for your health, your sanity, your career went a different direction, but not a wrong direction. You know, you went in so many other ways, and it's great. Was that released on vinyl, do you recall?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well,
you can get it on it's up here somewhere. Yeah. It's on Naxos, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I think, you know, you could have easily, or anyone in particular could burn out doing the same thing, repetition, and you might've just hated what you're doing, but, you know what? I'm proud of you, Howard, Mr. Blake, you did a fantastic job.
Well, I'm honored.
You know, I really hate to do this, but I feel like it may be pulling teeth with you. Can we end this talking about a little collection of snow, maybe formed into a human form? Can I ask you a couple questions?
Go for it.
All right. Snowman is 26 minutes. The most impacting thing of the whole movie is, I think, the very end, where it becomes a very bitter ending for the boy, James. But it's also a life lesson snow will fall again, life will come again. How deep or philosophical was this this score as you were penning it?
Well, I think the tune itself, Walking in the Air, as I say, I wrote at a very crucial moment in my life when I turned my back on making enormous amounts of money and being enormously successful and run and just disappeared. And I just was swimming in the sea and walking in on the beach, and nobody knew where I was. And it was this exact moment in my life I thought, I cannot go on with that life I've been having. And somewhere in it was, I was 3 months on that beach, and somewhere towards the end of that time, I started to think I'd like to write a symphony, and I'd like it to start with a theme that expresses innocence, the innocence that we're born with. When we're born, every one of us, there's nobody's printed anything on us. We can go any direction from devilish horror to great beauty and good. It's all within us to do. And I just thought everybody could have innocence and could keep innocence. But you know, it's the difficulty in life is finding that balance and how to do that. And so I wanted to write a theme of perfect innocence. And in fact, I was walking along the beach and I just heard. So I wrote that theme, and as I said, I didn't know what to do with it, but that tune somehow expresses something which is sort of much bigger than me. It expresses something about, like, something that we're all looking for something in life, like more than us. People all want the best. We want, and that. So, various people said that tune has inspired. It's something about moving by hope and doing all the things you would like, you hope you might do. That's got that feeling. So I think when I got to the snowman and that I got this moment of this film and just the idea of the snowman, the fact that snowman is a very interesting. It's not a person, it's not a grown-up who teaches the boy about what, it's a snowman who knows, he doesn't know how to turn the light on. He doesn't, the boy shows him, look, you can turn a light on. Look, and the snowman says, look, we can fly, come with me. I mean, it's about innocence and about, the whole film is about how we would love to be if it were possible. And I think it's that has such an immense attraction. People are very uplifted by it. And I just sat down, I had that tune. The whole score, 26 Months, emanates from that tune. Until, I mean, it eventually becomes... This is the same tune, and it all emanates, all of tunes, all out come out of that. So there is something, I think, does that answer your question?
Oh, I think it does. Like you said, it inspires hope, and it gives us the idea that we can, you know, there's nothing impressed upon us. It's freeing, and I think it's, you know, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, Blake. You have the Nutcracker Suite. You have Peter and the Wolf, and you have the Snowman. Three, I would say, the trilogy of iconic, true Christmas and other other era musical journeys that we are taking on. I mean, you've given us a great gift, Mr. Blake.
Can I just read you a little quote from Tin Cup Review USA recently? I would prefer our children to see this film, The Snowman, and listen to this music. The lyrics, the music, and this boy's voice come from somewhere magical. Every now and again, man creates something that is worthy of ringing through eternity. Quite something to say.
Yeah, can see that it's meant a lot to you. And I mean, 40 years now, 40 years now, 38. I guess the only way to end this is a little bit of trivia. Peter Auti is actually the boy who recorded the famous song.
Yeah.
Do you remember that session? Do you, I mean, why is he not getting the credit?
I saw him the other day, actually. What happened is this. When I first written it as a tune, I was recording it. That's back in 82. And we tried several boys from schools. They weren't good enough. And I said to the same Elaine Gould, I was talking about the soprano, I said, where can I find the best soprano in the world? Well, she said, I think St. Paul's Cathedral, because the choir teacher there is just the best teacher of voices in the world. So how do we get in touch with her? She said, I'll ring him up right now. She rang him up. She said, I'm with Hal Blake, he's got this tune. We'd like the best boy you've got in St. Paul's Cathedral to sing it, record it. Okay, he said, well, you come after service in St. Paul's on Sunday and I'll line up six different boys, you can hear them and choose one. So we did that. We chose this boy and it was Peter Auti. And the next day I took him to Delaney Lee, little tiny little voiceover box, ran the track into his headphones, and we recorded it in a voiceover box. When we put it on the film, it sounded absolutely fantastic. So now, that's 82. 4 years went by, and I hadn't seen Pete. We'd done it in concert a bit, but I'd lost touch like with Peter Auti. And one day, great advertising. Who are the great advertising firm at that time?
In the 80s, it was Saatchi.
Maurice Saatchi rang me and he says, I've got six enormous mega stores of Toys R Us opening in London. He said, and I want to use your tune, Walking in the Air, for the tune, for Toys R Us. He said, but I want it a bit shorter with slightly different words. Would you do that? Could you find me that wonderful treble again? So I rang up Peter Auti and he said, hello. I said, has your voice broken?
Yes, he said, I'm a bass now.
Oh, I said, well, that's all right. You've just lost a very nice job. Anyway, nice to talk to you. So anyway, I needed to do something. And I remembered I had seen on television, like a couple of days ago, a boy singing from a carol concert somewhere in Wales. And I heard this boy, I don't know what his name is, see if you can find out who he is. So he said his name's Ali Jones. And I said, well, see if you can get him into Abbey Road studio Thursday morning. And we'll get an orchestra and we'll re-record it. So we were only going to record, it's funny how things work. We were only going to record like 25 seconds for this advert. And I worked quite a lot at that time with EMI. So I rang up the head of production and I said, actually, you're going to have a boy there and you can have an orchestra there. I suggest you record the whole song while you're there. It won't cost you any more. And it might work as a single, right? I said, Sony won't allow, I'm signed to Sony, unfortunately. I can't come and work for EMI, I'm sorry. But I'll send a conductor up to do it. So I did it. It went to the top of the hit parade. It was number three in the hit parade, like woof, like that, in front of the Rolling Stones and God knows, unbelievable. Very, very, you know, it was an amazing, amazing hit. And so that was really, that is made, what happens then, that took the film, made it very considerably more fun. It had all already come out on an album by CBS, Masterworks, but that's why they wouldn't let me conduct that, because I couldn't have two on opposing labels.
Okay.
So then that came out. So that's the story. So Pete Doherty didn't get the credit that, although he's still credited on the album and on the original. And he now is a very fine tenor singing at Covent Garden. So he is an operatic tenor. But Ali Jones is the most popular disc jockey in this country, and he does okay, so we don't have to worry about him.
Well, I can tell you that the first time I saw The Snowman, I think I was probably 8 or 9. My dad had just gotten he worked for Sony, so he got to bring home some, not to say prototype equipment, but he brought home a little Hi8 or a video camera. And I guess Sony was experimenting with putting out entertainment or movies on that format. So we watched Beetlejuice and a couple of the movies, and Snowman was one that we watched through that video camera. Huh. And you know, we plug it into a TV, and long story short, from 8 years old, you have been in my life, and it's just been a thrill speaking to you about this high point in your career, but all the myriad of other things that have made you wildly successful and endeared yourself to the public. So, Mr. Blake, I cherish you. Thank you for your time.
You say the nicest things. It's been a pleasure to do it. If I fall over and disappear, you can take it. I've gone.